because this might be the inner chronicle of what we are, and we have to articulate ourselves, otherwise we would be cows in the field.
Hello, and welcome to Cows in the Field. This is a movie podcast. I'm Justin.
I'm Laura.
And today we're going to talk about the Blair Witch Project.
Yay!
But before we get into that, I just want to mention some fun housekeeping stuff. One of which is that we have a schedule now planned out of what movies we're going to cover and when those episodes will be released. So this episode is being released on June 19th. It's the Blair Witch Project. And episodes typically are going to drop on Fridays, and it's going to be every other Friday.
Yep.
So July 3rd is Children of Men. July 17, Searching for Bobby Fischer. July 31st, Vampire's Kiss. August 14th, Titanic. And August 28th, Forrest Gump. So I should also say that we have a website now that will, all the episodes will be on that, along with some extra discussion, and you can engage on the discussion if you like as well. The website is cowspod.wordpress.com. So join us there for you know, more about each of these movies that we discuss and links to episodes, and we'll post information about upcoming stuff there. Okay, so we're going to talk about The Blair Witch Project today, which then this movie came out in 1999, and it was surprising to my to find this out, but it was the 10th highest grossing film of 1999. And part of the reason I find that incredibly surprising is that 1999 is just such a stacked year for movies.
Mm-hmm.
It set a record for the most profitable movie ever made. In particular, and so the way they measure this is by the budget to revenue ratio. And I mean, it's just kind of unbelievable when you hear these numbers. So it was made, it cost them $35,000 to make, and it grossed $248 million. So it just defies anything we can even imagine. And I think one of the questions we wanted to start out with was just, you know, what is it about this movie that made it so popular at that point in time? This is the end of the 90s.
People were ready for something different at this point. It is like the first found footage movie of any import, I think, ever, really. We'll go into like the brief history of found footage later. But it feels completely and totally different, I think, from anything else that had been going on in the 90s in terms of horror. There had been a lot of like the kinds of movies that we talked about in our Dory episode, a lot of franchises at this point, teen slasher movies where, you know, people get picked off one by one, lots of gore, lots of things that are right there on the screen, and they're getting a little baroque, and this movie is so sparse and leaves so much to your imagination. It must have felt like totally different at the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, I mean, I think also that audiences it's likely that audiences were just aware of all of the horror tropes that they had inherited from people like John Carpenter and others, you know, from the run of slasher movies in the 80s. That really carries over into the 90s. Then you have like a movie like Scream in 1996, where it's almost parodied how meta the movie is about those tropes. Like they cite them in the movie. They actively, you know, all the characters are aware of them. They follow those rules. Some break them. And I mean, it's just one of these things where if audiences were that receptive to a meta horror film at that point, it seems likely that they were growing tired of that kind of horror, in that they were just tired of a slasher movie where there's a final girl and there's an unstoppable force going around and killing everyone. And so I wonder if part of the success of this movie is that it felt so fresh in that time, in that it was just, there was nothing quite like it. It wasn't following any of the typical genre tropes at the time, at least. You don't ever see the Blair Witch. You don't ever encounter anything gruesome.
No.
And there's no real,
I mean, the teeth are kind of gruesome, but that's it.
Right. But the kind of scares that I think would have fuel to move the horror kind of movies in this in, involving suspense and jump scares and these sorts of things are just not really present in this movie. It's more about creating a mood and atmosphere and unease mm-hmm. and unsettledness and something that's unnatural. And really, it's just like a movie about a bunch of people getting lost in the woods for the most part. But that itself is scary.
And yeah, that's what I love about that.
It's
that,
mundane.
That hit me way harder this time than when I watched it as a kid. That, like, I'm not that scared of witches. I'm a little scared of witches, but I'm not that scared of witches, but I'm very scared of getting lost in the woods.
Yeah, it's, well, I mean, there is a horror to that. And I think, like, that, because of Blair Witch, I mean, you know, it kicks off this whole found footage thing, which we'll talk about, but it also kicks off, I think, like, a kind of renaissance of, like, just the horror in these sort of natural disaster kind of things. Like, I'm thinking of a movie like Open Water, where the it's really just like two people who are trying to tread water and sharks are like trying to eat them.
Right.
And that's like the entire movie. And I mean, I feel like that, you know, this has this supernatural element, but a great amount of the horror is just getting caught and getting trapped in the woods and just that ending up like potentially running out of food and water and just being lost and being feeling like you're going insane because you feel like you're not going in circles, but you keep end up going in circles. And I find that is really scary. So I think, you know, this kind of simultaneously like bringing it down to earth, bringing down the genre back down to earth. And then also I think suffusing it with a kind of real supernatural element. You know, I think that is really effective. I mean, another thing that of course was very effective about this movie was that it's the first movie to have like a real viral marketing campaign, as far as I know.
The marketing was insane.
Because they start out with a website. They don't even have the movie. They like have a website and they screen this documentary on Sci-Fi Channel ahead of the movie.
Right.
And all the promotional stuff is like they created signs saying like these people are missing.
Yeah, they did that at Sundance and they listed all the cast as like presumed dead, like missing or presumed dead.
Yeah, you're supposed to think like, oh, I'm watching like a reconstructed documentary a la say like Grizzly Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is that must have just been so effective because, you know, it's the early days of most people getting the internet in their homes, having some kind of dial up in their homes. Like, you know, other people probably had it before then, especially people on college campuses, but before that, it really isn't, you know, it's not around as much. And so people are out there checking. They're like checking on the website and they're wondering. But the combination of these two things, I think, led to its success. And it, of course, had a really great word of mouth campaign. People were saying like, oh my God, it's so scary. Or some people were saying it's total garbage.
Yeah.
And so now then everyone had to have an opinion. So you had to go see it. And so I can imagine that sort of steamrolled it into the 10th highest grossing movie of 1999. This movie, I think, has a very particular meaning and history for you in particular.
Okay. Yeah, we can get into that now. Laura's Horror Corner. So I underwent, because of this movie and because of The Sixth Sense, because of the year of 1999, I was so destroyed by these two movies that my dad and I underwent a desensitization program.
Tell me what happened when you watched this movie.
Sure. So I was always a scaredy cat. Like, always, always, always. There was kind of an ever-growing list of things in my house that I wasn't allowed to watch because they gave me nightmares one time. Like, when I watched the Halloween episode of Saved by the Bell and it gave me nightmares. And then my mom said I couldn't watch Saved by the Bell anymore, even though it was just the Halloween episode. That show's not scary normally. I felt that was very unfair. But I was up all the time bothering my parents because I had nightmares and they were like so sick of it. but I think so in 1999, these two movies come out, The Sixth Sense and The Blair Witch, that are both like water cooler movies. I didn't have cafeteria movies in my case because mm-hmm. I was in middle school and I desperately wanted to be a part of that conversation. And so my parents watched both of those movies with me or they watched Blair Witch with me and they watched one half of Sixth Sense with me because I bailed halfway through.
Wait, you got through all of Blair Witch, but not all of Sixth Sense?
Correct.
Interesting.
I think that's obvious why. I think it's because you see more stuff in The Sixth Sense. And The Blair Witch just is like creepy and moody, but you can keep hanging on. But at any rate, I think my parents thought I would be okay at 12. I think they thought this whole like wake, you know, come into their room and say I had a nightmare is over. Yeah. I wasn't coming into the room anymore, but I was not sleeping. I did not sleep for like days after Sixth Sense. And my dad sort of understood that I was really bummed out that I wanted to be a part of these conversations, but I also like on a visceral physical level, like could not handle it watching movies like this. So that's why we sort of platformed out increasingly scary movies to desensitize me. Mm-hmm. Moving up to, I think the pinnacle movie was Silence of the Lambs, mm-hmm. which some people might disagree with as being like the most scary movie ever. But I do think it's one of the most scary movies.
What did you start with?
We started with like Sleepy Hollow.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah. But was that like, how did that, you know, if you're comparing it to the Hot Wings scale, so are you, is that like Sriracha, Tabasco, or is that like you're already in the medium heat?
I think I was already in medium heat.
Hot for you. That you were like, whoa, I'm feeling it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So I judge horror movies in terms of like, is there an image that is seared into my brain at 3 a.m? And in the case of Sleepy Hollow, there's like a torture device that has like, it's like a coffin with a bunch of spikes in it. And that was seared into my brain at 3 a.m. So yeah, that one did it for me.
Okay.
Now I don't think it's scary at all.
Well, you're on the other end of that project.
It worked, guys.
Okay, so Sleepy Hollow, and then where did Blair Witch land?
So Blair Witch happened before desensitization.
I know, but did you watch it during the process of desensitization?
No, I watched it before I was ready. And like, I really was kind of little. I mean, I was 12, but we had this like rule that we could only eat in the kitchen, but you could see the TV from the kitchen. So if I wanted to eat my treats, I had to like sit on the floor of the kitchen and watch the TV. So I watched it.
How
like
big
a really
was the TV? Was it big enough that
angle.
You could actually see anything?
No, you'd be so upset at the viewing angle and distance that I was watching this at. So, and also you can't see shit in Blair Witch. So like, I don't know how I was even getting anything, but I just remember I had gotten like the like Mondo box of Whoppers at Blockbuster.
Yeah.
You know how they're like,
yeah, it's a good pairing
size.
With Blair Witch, which will make you completely nauseated.
Yeah, I had such a stomach ache. I think I was just like pushing them into my mouth, like just like out of like a fear response. And my mouth was getting all malty and gritty. And I like was just like, I'm going to puke. I'm so scared.
Yeah.
And I've had too many Whoppers.
How old are you? 12?
I think so.
Yeah. So I was probably 15. I guess it was 15. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I watched this movie at a sleepover,
That's a great viewing experience.
And it was fun. You know, it was fun. I was sleeping over with some friends. And I remember that after, you know, after we turned it off, we were in the basement. We were at a friend's house in the basement. And I remember, you know, I think somebody was like, I want to go upstairs, but I'm too scared to go by myself. You know,
yeah, that
kind
me.
Of situation.
That would be me. I ruined a lot of sleepovers.
Yeah, it was fun. But that was I remember like being like, wow, this is, I remember being very scared, trying to downplay it, obviously, as you would in that kind of situation. And, you know, in retrospect thinking, yeah, this was really fun and scary. Like, I didn't really like horror though back then. So I was
not the biggest horror fan.
No,
I
did these movies because they were the kind, you know, it was what you do in high school. You have to go and be part of that experience with people. Yeah. And you know, I didn't really enjoy it that much, but I got it together and I did what I needed to do, to be with the people. But I never really enjoyed the process of going through it. And that's definitely changed. I mean, watching this movie today, it's an incredibly enjoyable movie to watch. I think it's really well made and it's super effective at what it sets out to do. And it's fun to watch what it's setting out to do and see how it's executing in that way. And I found that excellent. But that's the way I appreciate horror, is I appreciate the craft of horror. I think you engage in a more visceral way with it.
Yeah.
Emotionally and viscerally, you want to feel that kind of fear and panic response, whereas I typically don't want to. I just appreciate the ability to execute the genre tropes effectively.
Yeah. No, I do. I do get a charge out of it. And now that, because I still feel fear when I watch these movies, even though I've seen Blair Witch multiple times.
That's
even
interesting.
Though I've been
so
through
still,
yeah, I do. Yeah. I mean, I definitely didn't like want to go down the stairs in the dark after we watched this movie. I didn't want to go to our basement after we watched this movie.
And I kept making jokes about the little stick figures I kept finding.
And I kept making jokes about how I'm going to leave you. I didn't like it. It's not funny. No, I still like had that fear response. It's just that like when I was 12, it was so all consuming. I thought I was going to die and I couldn't sleep. And now like I get the charge and I feel it. And I feel that little like rush of panic and fear, but it's totally, you know, manageable.
Yeah.
But I haven't lost it completely, which is fun.
Yeah. Was there in the process of doing this horror festival that you were doing with your parents, were there any movies that like you came away from thinking like, whoa, that was a lot better than I was expecting it to be?
Better how? Like better quality?
I don't know. Just you enjoyed it more? I mean, because I can imagine going in thinking like there's certain movies like you never want to watch. And then you watch them in the process of this and you're like getting over your horror. And then you're like, oh, actually, that was really fun. Like,
no, so my dad loves movies and we used to like watch the AFI list. You remember they would do these like screenings in the summer. They had the 100 AFI movies, but then the 100 most heart-pounding AFI movies, which by the way, just watching clips of the heart-pounding movies gave me nightmares.
Yeah. That's tough.
but I wanted to watch everything. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to like watch The Exorcist and I really wanted to watch The Shining and I wanted to like be a part of that. So there wasn't anything that I was dreading going into. I think I had like a little bit of anticipatory anxiety, like when you're like going up the roller coaster and you need to click. Like when we were about to put in the DVD. Yeah. But it wasn't like I was like, oh, I never want to see that movie. I wouldn't have gone to the trouble of a desensitization program if I didn't want to see these movies.
That's interesting. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to come back to this point, actually, when we talk about what is it that is attractive about horror. And I'm really curious what your thoughts are on that. But let's maybe set that aside because we're going to come back to it.
Okay. I will answer your question in another way in that I think one of the first movies that I remember having like a lot of fun with and not just like, I can get through this, like back to the hot wings thing. Like when you get to the hot, like when you watch some people eat these hot wings, they're just trying to like,
they're just struggling. Physically,
yeah. They're struggling and they can do it, but it's no fun. I remember watching The Ring and like having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And that was an accomplishment.
Even at the really scary parts or.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah. And I've,
and
you
this
know,
is first time through or.
I think so.
Wow.
Yeah. And then my dad and I went to go see Ring 2 in theaters. Yeah. Like that's where I was at. I was able to go to a theater and see a scary movie. I think it's Ring 2
High Voltage. Yeah, sorry. It's Ring 2 Maximum Rings.
No, it's Ring 2 Please Rewind.
Is it? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Be Kind Rewind.
Yeah.
The second question that we want to get into at this point is why did it take Hollywood almost 10 years, almost a decade to figure out that like you could do Blair Witch again? Like basically you could do another found footage movie that could make, maybe it's not going to make 7,000 times its budget, but maybe it could double, triple, quadruple its budget because the budget is nothing. It doesn't cost very much to make these movies and they're incredibly visceral and can be really effective. And so why did it take Hollywood so long? What's the next found footage movie after Blair Witch?
I think there may be like some really like some one sleeper ones, but I think the ones that are famous come in 2007 and 2008, which is wild. So Wreck came in 2007. That's the Spanish language film. And then Quarantine, the American version of it in 2008. Mm-hmm. And then Cloverfield in 2008 as well. Paranormal Activity is floating around. I think technically sometimes it's called a 2007 film because that's when it hit festivals, but it wasn't wide release until 2009.
Yeah.
So you may think that Wreck and Paranormal Activity are kind of like neck and neck.
Yeah.
But it all of a sudden seems like 2007, 2008, like these movies start popping back up again. I think maybe it's just multiple times found footage movies have had sort of bad vibes or sort of bad connotations attached to them. When I was looking up just like where the genre came from, the first found footage movie is called Cannibal Holocaust, which is an Italian faux documentary. But it was not like The Blair Witch in that it did show a lot of gore and was really over the top. And it was banned in many countries because it was depicted real animal slaughter. And people were like very upset about it. People thought it was real. The director was apparently arrested on charges of murder, obscenity, and distribution of snuff. And the actors had to like come on live TV and be like, no, we're alive. So the charges would be dropped.
Yeah.
And that maybe speaks to more of like people's gullibility in 1980 about like particularly around visual media. Like if you see it on a screen, it must be true or something. But I think after that, you know, there was a bit of a stigma attached to found footage, not just about like cannibal Holocaust, but there was a backlash to this movie too as well after Blair Witch. Despite the fact that it made so much money, it was not, you know, universally embraced as a good movie. A lot of people complained about it being so shaky and looking, you know, kind of crappy.
Yeah.
And people were saying they were like getting seasick in theaters. And, you know, I think people like it made a lot of money, but a lot of people would sort of go to hate watch it or complain about it. And so I think like that might have confused the narrative a little
bit. So that's a possible is that there's a reaction, a negative reaction to the movie. They think, well, I don't want to be associated with that. So they kind of let it simmer.
Right. Right. And a negative association specifically to the found footage elements.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. Here's another hypothesis, which is that the video quality needed to get better. It needed to improve. And we were really close to it actually getting to a point where, you know, you can screen movies that were shot on a video in a theater and it looked good. I mean, now almost everything is shot in video format.
Yeah.
Very little is shot on film. Nothing, almost nothing is screened on film. Everything is screened digitally. And so, but you know, for a long time, it was not that way. And we're right on the cusp here in 99 with prosumer level videography that allows you to actually have interchangeable lenses and do things that you could do with film on basically like broadcast level quality video. Of course, this movie's not shot on that. This movie's shot on high 8 video and 16 millimeter film, but I think really we're right on the cusp. And I think once that video quality gets better, then when you screen it on the big screen, it doesn't look like a bunch of blocks, like a bunch of Lego blocks. And I think at that point, then audiences, even though they can tell, oh, this is video, it's, you know, whatever, it's going to still, they'll be able to digest it as cinema, as opposed to just like, I'm watching someone's home videos, which I like, why am I paying $16 or whatever, $10 or whatever it costs
right.
to come and watch someone else's home videos? Like, I at least want to see something cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think maybe we needed to get to that point where the quality of the video is good enough that it can distinguish itself.
Yeah. I mean, there is still a bit of a lag because 28 Days Later is like 2002, 2003, right? That's entirely shot on.
That is. Yeah, that's true.
I saw it in theaters and I don't remember thinking this looks like garbage. Although when I watched it later, I was like, whew, this is a tough watch.
It looks terrible. But I think, that's we're still on the cusp, right?
Right.
That's not quite the level where it needs to be. And then a few years later, I think you have some of the Sony cams and things and then it's then now you're in 1080 zone and it's a lot better. And but I think it just took that's one hypothesis. It really, you needed that quality to catch up.
No, that makes sense. Cause even if you were to do, cause they did a combination of the video and the 16 millimeter.
Yeah. But,
or is it super, what
it's
did you,
16 millimeter,
it's 16 mil.
But they scratched it up because they might've shot it even on, again, I don't know for sure, but it looks like crappy 16 millimeter. Like 16 mil, you can see grain for sure. But this looks like fuzzy 16 mil.
Mm.
So it's either they shot it on like degraded 16 millimeter stock, or they shot it on fast, like high ISO 16 millimeter stock, which would have added extra grain and potentially made it even more fuzzy looking.
Right.
Because it just, I mean, like, you know, Darren Aronofsky shot Black Swan on 16 millimeter. But you wouldn't think like Black Swan, it just looks beautiful, right? Compared to what
Black
you're seeing.
Black Swan, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
He loves 16.
Oh, I thought you were going to say pie. You know, I was like, okay. Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, it did look like crap. Because I was just going to say you couldn't do found footage movies for that type of budget on film, right? Because it's the film that makes the budget.
I think back then, probably it wasn't that hard to get a hold of. I mean, the issue there is the camera, but apparently they sold the camera on eBay afterwards. just because they wanted to keep the budget costs low.
Right.
So,
but there is a barrier to entry, I think.
Like, yeah, you got to buy a 16 millimeter camera and you got to buy a bunch of film. You got to get developed. Like, it's a lot easier.
You have
easier
to know what you're doing more than if a point and shoot video, right?
Yes.
Or,
You know how to load it and how to handle it. That's right. And how to like expose the film correctly. So there's complications mm-hmm. there. So, okay, we've got some hypotheses. Who knows? But I think if anything, what we've seen now is the stagnation of the horror genre that I think that was laying in the groundwork before Blair Witch kicks, kind of re-energizes it, had, of course, led after Blair Witch to a million copycat movies, which led to what I think we are now at, which is stagnation in the horror genre, at least among found footage movies. I think when people now see that it's a found footage movie, they go, oh, it's like eye rolling. It's annoying. Yeah. It's lame. It's hack. And that, I just think, you know, where it's going to take another 15 years before somebody reinvents that found footage genre. But
I think one of the things that is eye-rolly about found footage movies is it's hard. Now everybody does have a phone on them and they record a lot of their lives, but it's hard to make the found footage part of it like feel integral and woven within the narrative of the
right.
of
That's
the
really
movie itself.
Point.
And yeah. Blair Witch does that so well. Yeah. There's so many justifications that are both explicit and implied in throughout the movie about why they keep pointing the camera out during yeah. like these horrifying moments. Because yeah. that's always where people are like, well, why would you be filming that? Why wouldn't you just put down the camera and run? And they talk about that in the Blair Witch Project.
Yeah.
But a lot of found footage movies,
it even becomes a point of contention.
It does. Yeah. They're fighting over it because, you know, yeah, they keep saying like, quick, that we're not watching. We're making a movie about us being lost in the woods. We're making a movie about the witch.
Yeah.
and Heather says things like, it's all I have. And
yeah, and they actually remark on it. Like when Josh takes the camera and he looks through it, he says, oh, I now see what you're so attracted to about looking through the lens here. It's as if like you're looking at reality, but it's like somehow safer because it's not real.
Yeah. Right. I think that stuff is really well done. In a movie that's sparsely, you know, sparse in dialogue, at least like written dialogue. I think it's really well done. And there was, I think, after Cloverfield was a big hit, there were a bunch of movies that just add in like a found footage element just because, and have no importance to the plot and doesn't feel like it matters. And then it just becomes like a gimmick or a framing device. And that's like the worst. It's sort of like with those television shows that are like faux documentary that came after The Office, with the interview
that's a
style.
Great point.
Like,
yes.
Why is Modern Family like
yes.
that? Nobody knows, but it was just like of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, they just use it as a framing device and we're used to it enough that it makes sense to our minds and we don't question it. Yeah, that's really good. I think if anything though, that's one of the things that's really effective about the Blair Witch Project is that the narrative is spliced up because the camera isn't always on. Sometimes the camera comes on, they're in mid-conversation, sometimes it goes off at unexpected times, and it just is kind of flipping on and off, and you're getting snippets of their life as they go through this project. You're getting snippets of these interviews that they're doing before they go out there. And I just think that is, you know, I think that adds to that realism effect and that it's not like, oh, let's turn, before we have this conversation, let's like turn the camera on and like put it on a tripod and point it at us and then like have the conversation, you know, like there's none of that. They're just like walking around bickering and the camera comes on. So, okay, another thing we wanted to talk about is coming into this movie, you know, this is a horror movie, and it's, I'm a little bit, you know, mystified, I think, by the horror genre. And mm-hmm. and I wanted to sort of think a little bit about what makes for something being horror, and what also is the attraction to the horror genre, and why is it that we want to watch horror and consume horror media.
Yeah, why did I go through a desensitization program just to be able to watch these movies?
Well, exactly. And I mean, you know, one answer which you already hinted at is like, well, you wanted to be part of the club. And for sure, that was a big reason I was in these movies in theaters. I would go and even see them. It's because, well, my friends wanted to go see it. I don't have a choice. So I pay and I go sit there and I suffer through it.
Yeah,
and then I
dragged along with a bunch of teenagers. Yeah. There's like 10 of you. You take up a row. Yep,
so that was
me.
The other thing was, you know, my dad wanted to see blah, 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 Blade or whatever. And then I'm just there because he wanted to see it. So I'm there. And I didn't want to, you know, ruin his fun by being like, I'm scared I'm going to go home. So, okay, so there's that, but that's not what we're interested in. So there's something else about the attraction of horror. But before we even get there, like, I want to just think about, like, what horror is. And I think it's important in thinking about this question to distinguish the feeling of being horrified from the feeling of being scared. And I think that a lot of movies that actually go by the genre title horror are not really actually interested in horrifying. They're interested in making people scared.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a big difference. We don't have a genre title for scary movie. That, I mean, you could say that, but that's not really, we don't have like a word for that.
Yeah.
So horror gets used as the catch-all.
I know. And that's funny too, because I feel like, for example, I think slasher movies are firmly within the horror genre. But if I say my favorite horror movie is Silence of the Lambs, some people will be like, it's not really a horror movie because it doesn't have like a supernatural baddie and it doesn't like follow those tropes. But the Silence of the Lambs movie is horrifying.
Yes. So this is the thing I want to get at. Yeah. So what is this notion of being horrified? So here's something that's, I think, scary, but not horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
So if suddenly someone jumped into this room, right? And we didn't expect them. We'd be scared. We'd feel like flight or fight, and we would have, you know, we'd have all that like rush and everything, and our pulse would quicken, and maybe there'd be like a sweat on the brow, and then we'd have to come down. Okay, so that's like scared, but it's not horrifying. We're not like, oh, especially if it's just like someone who we knew is in the house, and they just happened to startle us. We're like, oh, okay, well, not horrifying. We just didn't expect you. But I think similarly, there are things that can be horrifying, but not scary. Now, this is a little bit harder to come up with examples of, but one example I think is the xenomorph from Alien. So some people, I mean, of course, this is also scary for some people, but I think for some people, the xenomorph is actually like strangely aesthetically beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. It's this creature that has this, you know, all this like leathery, it's almost like spandex, right? And it's a creature that's like, I think, really, in like, there's an attraction to that sort of thing, right? And I think, so that's, but of course it's still horrifying. It's this horrifying creature. But I think a lot of people, especially people who've seen the movie a lot, they wouldn't be scared of the creature, but it can still be horrifying because it's, because of what it is, because of the thing that it is, how it's aesthetically presented and so on. So I think we want to distinguish being scared from being horrified. Now, with that in mind, of course, being scared is easy to identify. We kind of all know what that's like. What is it to be horrified? I think that's the real question. And I think when you start probing that question, it'll lead to interesting answers to the question of why we want to actually be horrified.
Right.
So one answer that's given by Noel Carroll about the question of what horror is that it's a mental state of agitation directed at something threatening and impure. So it has to have these two components of being threatening and impure. And the impurity for Carol is often the result of an unnatural combination of properties. So, you know, imagine a man with the head of a goat, something like that. It's just like unexpected. Like, why would there be a man with a goat head? Weird. And the idea of the impurity is that it's often disgusting or revolting. So it can kind of bring about this notion of nausea.
Mm.
You get this in The Blair Witch, and that the Blair Witch is described as this woman who's hairy, right? Who has hair all over her body like a werewolf or something, right? The other thing is that I think horrifying in The Blair Witch is that when the characters encounter those little stick figures.
I hate those
right?
stick figures.
It's horrifying because you think you went to bed, and then you wake up the next morning and there's like a million stick figures. And you're like, who did this?
They're all over the place.
Holy shit. Come up here quick! I need to use the CP!
Yo, there's all sorts of shit up here, man.
This is fucking crazy shit. Please, I gotta get this on 16.
Take the fucking camera. Okay.
I have no idea.
Jesus Christ. That's fucking creepy.
And this is no redneck. No redneck is this creative.
Can we get out of here now?
Yeah, please. Okay, I've got everything on video, man. Oh, Jesus Christ, I didn't even fucking see these, man.
That's it, Heather. Heather, you got enough, man. Let's go.
That's enough!
Stop taping! Enough. Please stop taping!
Okay. Okay, we're leaving right now.
Also, just side note, stick figures are creepy. I think, you know, True Detective uses that to great effect. People just making like little figurines out of woody, out of, you know, things you find in the woods. Maybe a little unnatural.
It's unnatural. Yes, that's the thing. It's unexpected and unnatural. And it's revolting in a way. You're like, oh, what is that? I don't understand. Here, another instance of that in the book, which is when they get to the shack. So first of all, the shack itself is in a way like revolting because it's this like run down, dilapidated mansion. It's quite big, right? Which just fallen into complete disarray. And yet we're sort of it's suggested that somebody's living here, right?
Yeah.
That something, some stuff is going on. And the other part that's unnatural and impure is when they go up the stairs, they see these bloody handprints all over the walls. And you just think like, so if somebody was like injured and running, you would, maybe they'd smear potentially, but you would have bloody handprints. Like what would be the cause of a bunch of bloody handprints?
Yeah, like clear handprints, like at a preschool, like when they're doing art projects. Yeah.
I mean, and there's just something unnatural about that. And I think that's the kind of thing that when you're horrified, it stays with you. It's the thing that keeps you up at night. It keeps you ruminating. When you're scared, well, okay, I'm scared in the moment, then I'm not. But the horror is this thing that keeps you scared in a way.
Yeah,
it sustains that fear.
It's
response.
The thing that I talked about, like the thing that's seared into my brain at 3 a.m. That's the horror part of it.
Right.
And not like the jump scare from that movie is not going to be, that's not what I'm going to be reliving at 3 a.m.
Yeah, you don't relive the jump scare. It's, you know, it's effective in the moment to like prime you to be horrified because it triggers the same kind of emotions and agitation, but it doesn't sustain itself. So now, of course, there's this unnatural, impure element. And I think this is really, what's really interesting is some of the answers about what it is that's attractive about horror have to do with this idea of trying to understand the unnatural. So one answer about why we are attracted to horror is actually given by H.P. Lovecraft. He wrote an essay on this. And Lovecraft's answer as to why we're attracted to horror is that it's an encounter. Horror is an encounter with something unnatural that provokes a sense of awe and wonder, that the world contains vast unknown forces. So here's how Noel Carroll puts it, apprehension of the unknown charged with wonder. Now, what's I think fascinating about that idea is that it's like, the way Lovecraft thinks of it is it's like deep down we desire or instinctually know that the world is this foreboding, completely unintelligible place.
Mm.
And of course now, you know, science and religion and our own experience, again and again, we make sense of things, right? We're like, oh, you know, gravity and whatever, you know, God did this and then, and it's all about making sense of the world around us.
Mm-hmm.
But Lovecraft thinks-
pulled under us.
Yeah, we-
every now and again.
Lovecraft thinks that we are attracted to this idea that we can't shake, that somehow like deep down, it's not going to make sense. Deep down, there are sort of forces at play that are beyond our understanding. And what horror is it's a sort of encounter with the unintelligible that allows us to sort of kindle that feeling, or even more perhaps confirm it, right? Confirm this instinctual feeling that we have. So that's one idea about horror is why we're attracted to it is because we want to feel like the world is a crazy place. Okay. Noel Carroll is not into that idea.
Mm.
Instead, Carroll thinks that we're actually driven, our desire for horror is a drive to make explicable the inexplicable. So it's a desire to uncover what it is that the Blair Witch, what's going on with the Blair Witch, to learn more about that. And it's this process of discovery that's exciting about horror.
Yeah, that feels more resonant to me as somebody who loves horror personally. I feel like I like it's like a controlled out of control feeling.
Mm-hmm.
you know, some people really hate horror and are like really surprised that I like horror movies, and they ask me why, and I'm like, well, I like to feel something, but I don't like roller coaster because I don't really want my body to be hurtling, you know, at a million miles an hour. That's a real feeling. That's my body in actual peril, and I don't like it. But if I'm sitting on my comfy couch looking at faux peril, looking at somebody else being in peril, I can kind of like feel that feeling in a safe and controlled way. It's like it's cathartic.
So is the idea for you that horror is a way, what it is it's a way for us to sort of make believe, or at least play in the sandbox of the feelings that we would get if we were actually in danger, but we're not actually in danger, but we just get to sort of play in the sandbox of feeling like we're in danger.
That's how I feel about
which it. Which is a kind, you know, which is partly to experience part of the spectrum of being a human being, right? Because as to be a full human being is to feel all these different experiences.
I feel many feelings.
But we could live a hermetic life where we don't feel those feelings. But then the idea, and in some respects, many of us would prefer to live such a life, right? We would prefer a life free of sadness and fear and, you know, feeling like the world is inexplicable, maybe. But then the idea is that to really enrich our life, we need to experience these things. And so what horror does is it kind of gives us an outlet to do that, a safe outlet, because we're not really in danger and so on.
Yeah.
I see. So that's
how I feel about it.
And you could say the same thing about, like, why are people attracted to, you know, to sad movies?
Absolutely.
Right. It's because it's a safe way to, it's a catharsis for your inner feelings that you know, otherwise...
Yeah, like those movies, though, are very taxing.
It's like an audition for real life, in a way.
Yeah, yeah. Like those movies are very taxing on me, though, because as you know, I do cry a lot in movies, and I run out of tears, and sometimes it hurts physically.
That's true, yeah. I mean, there is another question, which we won't have time to get into, which is, maybe we'll get into it at a later episode, but which is this question of what's sometimes called the paradox of fiction. Which is, why is it that we have genuine emotions that are elicited by something we know is
not real,
right?
Yeah.
It's not real. And the way Noel Carroll puts it is, I think, really is fascinating. So just suppose I told you that, you know, I don't know, some loved one died, and you might begin to feel all kinds of emotions and, like, you know, sadness and, guilt that maybe you didn't have a chance to call them and stuff, and then I tell you, oh no, I was just kidding, then those feelings will evaporate, right? They'll be replaced by a new feeling, namely, like, hey,
you asshole,
you don't do that. Yeah. Right, that's not nice. But certainly the feelings of sadness are gonna go away. I mean, maybe there'll be a lingering thing, but it's not quite.
Yeah, might just feel I should call them, but yeah, you know, you're not crying,
you're not
tears
actually
anymore.
Crying. And,
yeah.
But what's interesting is that when you're watching a movie, it's as if I told you in the same breath, here's this person, and then they die, but they're not a real person, so don't worry about it. If I told you, because of course you know when you're watching a movie, it's not real. And so then there's a question of, like, well, like, why, how can it actually elicit the genuine emotions? Because it does seem like it does. Anyway, we could talk about that at a later time. And I think what's interesting, of course, is that in a movie like Blair Witch, it's a movie where they're trying to make you think that it's real, right? And
right.
In order to help maybe smoothly elicit that fear response more provocatively or more strongly in its audience.
Yeah. Oh, I was also thinking, you and I have had this conversation a couple times about, you know, why women in particular seem fascinated, if not by horror movies, but by, like, serial killers and stuff. Like, there's this My Favorite Murder podcast. There's, like, a, you know, millions and millions of murderinos. And I think largely they are women. There are definitely male murderinos, but, and I am one of these too. I'm, you know, fascinated by serial killers and murder mysteries and all that. And I think it is partly to part of that thing about control and playing in the sandbox and playing out scenarios. I think women are, you know, serial killers are real. This kind of violence is real. And for the most part, women are the victims of it. And we're I think the fear that we feel walking down an alleyway or walking to our car in the middle of the night in an empty parking lot is different and far more acute than what men feel in those scenarios. And But if you read enough about serial killers, or if you read about those people who survived an attack from them, or if you learn about their MO, like maybe you can kind of like, it helps you kind of think through what would you do in that scenario, yeah, and helps you feel a little bit more empowered.
Yeah.
It's twisted, but that's one of my theories for why I think women are in particular seem like drawn to this.
Do you think there's also kind of like a fictional Stockholm syndrome thing where then there's this also attraction to the serial killer, like the fictional version of the serial killer? And that you're like fascinated by him, let's just say, and that you want to learn about him and what makes him tick and so on. Like, do you think there's also that component?
Yeah, I do think so.
Because I'm thinking a little bit of like Buffalo Bill, for instance, in Silence of the Lambs, or even, you know, Hannibal Lecter, where there's this desire to like, I mean, these characters are portrayed so sympathetically that like you want to know more about them and understand them.
Yeah. I mean, Hannibal's so charming.
Yeah.
And he's like a, you know, completely horrible person and has done horrifying things, and which you see on screen, and it's, you know, awful, but he's so charming.
Yeah.
And Ted Bundy, I think, you know, I think people are obsessed with Ted Bundy too, because he was good looking and charming and, you know, glib and pulled stunts like defending himself in court. And, you know, what, there were two movies about Ted Bundy that came out like simultaneously last year on Netflix. Like, they won't stop making movies about Ted Bundy. We're obsessed with him. Yeah, I do think that is part of it.
It's fascinating. Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, it's not something that I don't have that connection to the horror genre. I'm not really particularly interested in being scared. I do, though, understand and thinking about what is horror has helped me to, I think, crystallize what I think could be exciting and interesting about actually engaging with horror as, and what I mean by that is the feeling of being horrified as opposed to just being scared. And so for me, the Lovecraft thing actually resonated quite a bit in that, you know, I'm the kind of person who wants to try to make sense of everything as best I can, at least to convince myself that I have a grip on what's going on. And yet I do wonder if there's some kind of Freudian thing that's trying to frustrate me under its core, and that I'm somehow attracted to this idea that like maybe really it is inexplicable in some sense. And
I mean, that does make sense to me, in that one of the movies that I saw listed in like top 2000s horror movies when I was doing some research for this, one movie that kept popping up, which I felt didn't quite fit the category for me, was Mulholland Drive. Mm-hmm. Which you love. But yeah, it just made me think you are drawn to David Lynch movies are unintelligible at times, yeah, deeply mysterious, unsettling, but yeah, certainly not going, you know, they're not going to be explained.
Yeah. And I don't, my engagement with Lynch is not an attempt to unpack the puzzle.
Definitely not.
I think that's the wrong way to actually engage with his work. And I think that, yeah, for me in a way, maybe it's like, I just like to like let the aesthetic experience wash over me, and I don't try to interrogate it very much. And so it's a way of like turning off the analytic mindset and just enjoying at a purely
aesthetic
level, right? I mean, there's a way to enjoy it that's a meta enjoyment as well, where you're enjoying the craft of what he's doing and you're understanding what's going into this and, you know, what might be motivating him and that kind of thing. But it's less like, oh, I need to figure out like how the different parts of Mulholland Drive all fit together. I think that actually, that way of thinking about it kind of ruins it. And it's not what David Lynch wants you to be doing. And nowhere is this clearer than when David Lynch, when people ask him, like, what do you think about this theory? He's just like, I'm never going to tell you. Never going to tell you, because he does not want to ruin that pure basic aesthetic experience. And I think he feels that if he just told you, like, here's my interpretation of the movie, which I don't think he has one, but if he had one,
right,
and
I don't
told
know that
you,
he has one either.
You know, yeah. I think he would think it would ruin it for everyone. They wouldn't be able to enjoy it at you know, on this level. And I think to a certain extent, that's why a movie like Blair Witch can be so effective, is you never see the Blair Witch. It's never, nothing is explained. It just ends. And it's just, you're just like left feeling like, I don't know where I am, what's going on. I don't know what if I watched was real. I don't know.
You're like, we got to go to those woods. People are missing.
Yeah. Like, I don't know what, I don't know how to process. Like, I don't even have any way of processing this. And that kind of confirms this sort of deep, unnatural, inexplicable idea that's at the core of, I think, of a lot of horror that makes it so horrifying. There are all those things going on with this movie. There's also a kind of underlying theme, which comes out in the social dynamics between the characters. So the characters we have are Heather, Mike, and Josh. Heather is the leader of the group. She's the director. She is her project. She's also the star of the movie. Josh is the camera operator, and Mike is the audio guy. So they're basically just technical guys. In that sense, Heather is, and she's played this way, she's a strong female lead who has no romantic interest in these characters. Like, there's no romantic undertone here. They're just like people engaging in a joint project, students engaging in a joint project, and she's in charge. Now, one way of thinking about a lot of the stuff that happens in this movie is through that lens, is through the lens of a bunch of guys, two guys in this case, who are threatened by the woman who is their superior in it. Mm-hmm. This does come out in a few places. I mean, first of all, witches are historically, were women who were killed because the patriarchal society basically thought that they were getting too much power, right? They had their herbs and things, and it was just getting too out of hand. And so
pesky midwives.
And the midwives, and exactly. So we gotta just take care of them. And similarly in this movie, there's a really important part where Heather has been in charge of the map. And it's established that Heather is basically the only person who can read the map. She has the specialized knowledge of reading the map. Mike tries to look at the map and he's like, I don't understand.
It's all Greek to me, yeah.
She has a certain power because she has the map. She's the leader. They're following her. But then at one point, the map disappears and they all blame her. They're like, well, you were in charge of the map.
You've
like,
always had
come
the
on.
Map.
You've always had the map.
Did you take it?
No, I didn't take the fucking map, man. I'm not playing head games, man. If anyone's playing head games, you're playing head games, but I'm not playing head games.
I don't have it. We have to go. I'm serious. I don't have it.
Are you fucking serious?
I'm fucking serious. I don't have the map, okay?
Heather, that is so not cool, man.
I know it's not cool.
That is so not cool.
I know it's not cool.
That's the fucking, like, least responsible thing you could have possibly done, man.
I know that.
I gave you back the map, Heather.
I gave you the map.
I gave you back the map.
It's later pointed out that it was Mike who got rid of it. But at that point, Mike is gaslighting her, trying to make her doubt her own memories of the situation. So there's that. And this turns out, as I mentioned, Mike has thrown away the map. That's a power play, right? It's a way of removing this power, and because she has the specialized knowledge of being able to read the map, takes it away and puts them all on an even playing field. Now no one has any specialized knowledge. And I think that's interesting, right? It's a way of trying to level down. Because of course, in the process of getting rid of her power, they also put them in a more precarious situation because now they really have no idea where they are. They also blame Heather because of course she was the leader and everything, but she's directly blamed. And all this adds up to, there's that great scene where she's filming herself. She takes that responsibility. She blames herself for everything that's happened. And she apologizes to all of them.
Yeah.
I am so, so sorry for everything that has happened. Because in spite of what Mike says now, it is my fault. Because it was my project and I insisted on everything. I insisted that we weren't lost. I insisted that we keep going. I insisted that we walk south. Everything had to be my way, and this is where we've ended up. And it's all because of me that we're here now, hungry and cold and hunted.
And so you can see that over this constant berating of these men has put her in a situation where now she's just like, she doesn't believe anything. She doesn't believe her own memories, and she blames herself for everything that's happened.
And she says to over and over again, I insisted, I insisted. And for some reason that like in the word insisted feels like gendered to me, or the like the perception of a woman who insists as like a as a pest. Right. And
she nevertheless she insisted.
Yeah, exactly. That was also in my head. Yeah. But she sort of like tells the story as if she's like been sort of overbearingly bossy with them, you know, by insisting. But it is like, you know,
they go along totally willingly.
Yes, right? It's her project.
If anything, like they're totally gung-ho and excited to go, you know, it's not, she didn't force them to do anything.
No.
They're just, it's a camping trip for them, right? And they're ready to go and have a good time. Yeah. So I think that this stuff all gets twisted in these gender ways. Of course, you know, maybe if it was not gendered, there'd be similar things. But I think it's interesting that it is gendered, and then you can now filter it through that lens, especially given that the subject matter is that of a witch, right? Mm-hmm. That they're going to find. And it's a witch who was accused of killing a bunch of children and then basically tied up in the woods and left to the elements, as they put it.
Right. That's what you find out in The Curse of the Blair Witch and the sci-fi made-for-TV movie. I don't think you even know that much in the Blair Witch Project.
I can't remember if they talk about it in the interview, these pre-interviews they do before they go.
I don't know if they talk about her being left out in the elements. I don't know that we ever hear her name, Ellie, whatever.
Yeah, okay. We're getting into the lore here.
Yeah. I think what we decided after we watched The Curse of the Blair Witch is that knowing less about the Blair Witch is better.
Yes, a million times better. But that is also the thing of like when you see that and it's so inexplicable, like there is this desire to know more. It's fascinating. You're like, ooh, maybe if I like learn a little bit more, you know, it'll be less horrifying.
Right.
And it, you know, inevitably it is, because then you learn like, oh, well, here's the metaphysics of witchcraft, and you're like, ah, this, okay, so that's how it works. Okay. I mean, some things that you learn in
the— Did you learn all about the metaphysics? Is there a metaphysics of witchcraft? No,
but actually one thing I learned in the documentary that I thought was
witches are not real.
Really?
There's no metaphysics of witchcraft.
I don't know. There's a metaphysics of how many angels dance on the head of a pin. I was thinking maybe there could be there's a metaphysics of God.
Oh.
Anyway, so
moving right along.
So, but one thing I did learn in that doc that I thought was kind of cool is I will say two cool things that I got from
The Curse of the Blair Witch,
the doc, and Blair Witch 2016.
Okay.
Okay.
So tell me.
The two things are that they play with time. And they make explicit what's kind of implicit in the Blair Witch Project, which is that when you cross that stream, that fateful stream, you enter into this kind of time dilated, time warp sort of situation, where I think you've actually time traveled back to 17 whatever when the witch is active, and okay, so. Part of the reason for this is in 2016 Blair Witch, they make explicit that when the characters like split up, some of them are like, oh my God, they like, and they meet back up, that some of them are like, oh, we've been here for like 5 days. And the other characters are like, what? It's been 5 hours, right? Right. So they talk about how time is being warped. The other thing is then it's clear that what could be going on is that space is being warped. When you reach some edge, you end up back on the other edge. You never can escape. You're in this kind of like warp situation where you there's no way out. The other thing is in Curse of the Blair Witch, the documentary, it's revealed that the footage was found buried under the burned remains of that house.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, the remains were undisturbed. So it was like layers of dirt and debris and then ash. And they were like, it was undisturbed. So I don't know how they could have dug it up and put it right back perfectly, hinting that basically what it was that they died in 1758 or whatever, and then the house burned down later. So that they were actually time traveling, which I, you know, like I'm cool with that. I like time travel. So like, that's great. But in, you know, in another respect, it's like that movie does not need this. It definitely does not need it. It's creepy enough as it is.
Mm-hmm.
I just like the time travel stuff.
I think everything in the Blair Witch Project is so much smaller and so much sparser and so much just like left to your imagination than the Blair Witch 2016 version, which makes everything. I mean, at one point, the time dilation stuff and the time messing becomes so explicit that her alarm goes off and she's like, it doesn't make any sense. It's 7 a.m., but it's dark outside.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's creepy. This idea that it's like perpetual night. And I mean, it's cool. It's creepy. But not well
executed.
It's, yeah, don't, very, very much do not recommend that
but
movie.
I think the Blair Witch Project, the other thing that I really like about it is that there's also just like this constant hinting at or hope that it could just be people.
That's true. Yeah, yeah. Because that, yeah, that's right.
Because Mike says
that it's natural.
Right. Because at some point, Heather's sort of teasing him and she's like, well, what are you so scared of? You know, let's go investigate these noises. And he was like, you know, I don't, have you ever seen Deliverance? Like, I'm not going to mess with these people. If these people are, you know, messed up enough to like want to come and shake our tent in the middle of the night, I'm not going to play with them.
Yeah.
And then she says like, well, what if it's not people? And he's like, well, I'm not going to play with that either. Yeah. Either way. But I do, you know, like too, that there's always this throughout the whole movie, even though like stuff is happening, like they're heading due south all the time. And there's this constant wonder, like they're starving. They're being out in the sun all day. Like maybe they're just losing their minds. And in fact, there's nothing supernatural happening at all because we're not seeing any CGI flying around. We're not seeing any flashes. We're seeing no evidence of a witch except for their reactions to things.
That's true.
And I like that.
Yeah.
Sort
that's
of
definitely
second interpretation.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like gaslighting itself is horrifying. Like being led to doubt your own experiences in the world as true or whatever accurate is itself terrifying. So there we go. We've done a couple horror movies, horror thriller movies. Coming up, we've got some good stuff. We've got you know, next up will be Children of Men, which we're gonna have a very special guest on. And I, you know, please, if you're interested, if you like the podcast, follow us on Twitter. We are at CowsPod on Twitter. We have a website now, cowspod.wordpress.com. And we'll post updates and you can read more about our thoughts about these movies and other movies on that. And I hope you enjoyed The Blair Witch. Thanks, everyone. And we'll see you next time. Bye.